Hello and welcome to the Existential Echo Chamber podcast. This will probably be the final recording of 2020, and I think we can all agree. Good riddance. Before I get to the post, I just want to say thank you for those of you who have read the blog, those of you who encouraged me to move beyond the blog and to start the podcast. Apologies that the back half of the year have been crazy, that I have not got many posts out. So many things I had ready to go for you guys about Game of Thrones, origins of heaven and hell, as it relates to early Christian belief, you know, more follow-ups about the election, all that kind of stuff. I think we'll talk more about that early next year. I think definitely the Game of Thrones stuff, some of those things that I had situated, ready to go, I'll definitely get out to you guys. I didn't want Christmas to pass by without sharing some thoughts about Christmas, because for those of you who follow the blog and have listened to the episodes know, I certainly have made my opinions about Good Friday and Easter known, and I would like to share a quick post that I wrote for the blog about Christmas. So I appreciate all of you guys, and that is what this post is. In this post, I refer to it as the weary world rejoices. It's my thoughts on Easter. sorry. My thoughts on Christmas. My thoughts on Christmas 2020. The apocalyptic message preached by Jesus of Nazareth originated in part, no doubt, as a consequence of an earlier national yearning sincerely held by some Jews in the post-exilic period that God would one day restore the kingdom to his chosen people and install once more a Jewish king over a united land of Israel. Now, this king would be a descendant of Israel's most renowned monarch, David. And in fact, some suspected that he would be born in Bethlehem, which was known as the City of David. In ancient Israel, the king was said to be the Messiah, or the anointed one of God. So Messiah meant king. Messiah was a title for king. By the time of Jesus, this national yearning, which historians have named Jewish restoration theology, had waned for many as the occupation of Judea by the Roman Empire seemed absolute and unlikely to be altered. Some Jews held out hope for God's intervention on behalf of his people, citing the deliverance of the Hebrew slaves in Egypt, while others tried to incite rebellion, hoping that God would come to their aid. Others believed that in order for God to restore Israel, there would first need to be a spiritual restoration, and so these Jews withdrew from society and awaited God's intervention on behalf of those who were truly pure and faithful. Others, like John the Baptist, preached the coming of a kingdom from heaven and the imminent judgment of God on an unrepentant world. This apocalyptic message that God would soon intervene to destroy his enemies and install a righteous kingdom in Jerusalem, replete with its cosmic duality and notions of demonic warfare and sin and death and disease ravaging the earth, served as both an extension of earlier restoration beliefs and as a powerful answer to why the Jews experienced such consistent suffering. Now, by the time Jesus was born, sometime between about 6 and 4 BCE, many of the more devout Jews were poor, sick, and disillusioned with the Roman occupation of Judea. Most had probably given up or never really believed in the restoration of Israel and a return to Jewish rule under the leadership of a new Messiah. It had been hundreds of years since the royal line of David had collapsed. It's in this historical context that Jesus, who was called Messiah, was born. The birth of Jesus would not have been met by pomp and circumstance. There were no wise men from the east following supernatural stars to mark the birth of a baby who would be king. Likewise, there is no evidence of Herod, the client ruler of Judea, being so fearful of a peasant's birth that he ordered the slaughter of the male children throughout the land, forcing Mary and Joseph to flee with the infant to Egypt. Indeed, this story, which only appears in Matthew's gospel and bears little resemblance to the birth narrative in Luke, seems better understood as a literary device meant to recall God's son Israel being spared the slaughter of firstborn sons at Passover. Likewise, to address Luke's version of events, there is no historical evidence that an empire-wide census was held requiring citizens from all over the far-flung Roman Empire to return to their ancestral homeland. If a census occurred today requiring you to return to where your family lived 1,000 years ago, where would you go? How would you know? Why does Matthew have Herod slaughtering kids and forcing the family of Jesus, who are apparently just from Bethlehem in this version of the story, to flee to Egypt and then return years later to settle in Nazareth? Well, why does Luke record the family as being from Nazareth and then traveling to Bethlehem under the pretenses of an empire-wide census not mentioned in Matthew? Most historians of early Christianity find that the simplest explanation is that the contradictions in the birth narratives of Jesus arise from two different authors, whoever wrote Matthew and whoever wrote Luke, attempting to reconcile two contradictory traditions about Jesus. Number one, Jesus, everybody knew, was from Nazareth, a sort of redneck backwater in rural Galilee. And two, the Messiah was supposed to be born in the city of David, Bethlehem. Matthew solves this problem by having the family be originally from Bethlehem, before fleeing to Egypt and ultimately resettling in Nazareth. Luke takes a different tact, acknowledging that Jesus of Nazareth was from, well, Nazareth, but reconciles the two traditions by conjuring up a plot device to get the family from their small little town to the city of David just in time for Jesus to be born there, thus fulfilling his messianic destiny. And there are numerous other historical contradictions between the two birth narratives, which makes sense considering these two authors were Greek-speaking Christians, likely from different countries, who certainly were not comparing notes, and writing 80 years after the birth of Jesus, and influenced by different traditions. It is worth noting that our earliest surviving gospel, Mark, written some 10 to 15 years roughly before Matthew or Luke, and our latest gospel, John, which was written near the very end of the first century, don't mention the birth of Jesus, virgin or otherwise, or the town of Bethlehem at all. This too makes perfect sense historically, if not theologically. See, odds are, Mark never mentioned the virgin birth of Jesus in the city of Bethlehem because he had never heard that tradition. Likewise, the community that produced the final version of the Gospel of John clearly was not aware of these stories either. And our earliest Christian author, the Apostle Paul, author of at least 7 authentic letters in the New Testament and the alleged author of 6 others, who wrote every word of his epistles decades before the Gospels were written, he never mentions virgin births, mangers, Bethlehem, etc. either. But for the authors of Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, and Paul, what really happened when Jesus was born would have been of far less importance than what his birth, however insignificant at the time, provided for the world. God had heard the suffering of his people. He had seen the ravages of sin, death, and disease, and the toll it took on his people. And in the life, ministry, death, and resurrection of Jesus, God had chosen to initiate the ultimate restoration, not just of Israel, but of all mankind. The ministry, death, and resurrection of Jesus had signaled the beginning of the end. The kingdom of God was at hand, and soon he would send Jesus back to destroy God's enemies and restore the kingdom to all who thirsted for righteousness, whether they be Jew or Gentile, man or woman, slave or free. The birth of Jesus, then, was the first kindling of a new hope for the people of Israel, and for all of God's creation. The world sure could use some of that hope right about now. Perhaps this story, like so many others found in the ancient text of the Bible, need not be literally true to provide us with something of value to think about as we close out this exceedingly difficult year and look forward to our own shot at restoration for so many different areas of our lives in the days, weeks, and months ahead. If we, like the occupied and downtrodden Jews of Jesus' day, can simply refuse to stop searching for some light in the darkness, perhaps we too will find the peace we need to keep moving forward, no matter what challenges we face. Look around, friends. Hope is still to be found. Do you see it? I know I do. The weary world rejoices indeed. Merry Christmas.